Morning, everybody. On 88.1, I'm Tom Hall. This is Maryland Morning. The trial of William Porter, one of six Baltimore police officers charged in connection with the death of Freddie Gray, begins today. A Baltimore attorney and University of Baltimore law professor review the legal issues behind the trial and preview the defense and prosecution strategies likely to shape the proceedings. Then, Living Questions, our monthly series on the role of religion in the public sphere, a conversation with two pastors, an Episcopal priest and a Lutheran minister whose North Baltimore congregations decided to merge into one religious community. And I'll drop by the Peabody Library to talk with curator Gabrielle Dean about a new exhibit on the acclaimed Maryland novelist and educator John Barth. Plus, theater critic J. Wynn Russick reviews X's and O's, the new play at Center Stage that goes inside the NFL. First, these headlines.
I'm producer Rob Sivak. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming online at wypr.org/listen. Now, on with the show.
Morning, everybody. On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us. Hope you had a nice Thanksgiving weekend. In about 20 minutes, Officer William Porter, 26 years old, a three-year veteran of the police department here in Baltimore, goes on trial in the Clarence Mitchell Courthouse on Calvert Street in Baltimore. His is the first of six trials of officers charged in the death of Freddie Gray last April. Officer Porter is charged with involuntary manslaughter and second-degree assault, as well as misconduct in office. He has pleaded not guilty to those charges. Joining me this morning to talk about what we might expect in this trial, which is being closely watched here in Baltimore and well beyond, are two very experienced lawyers. Edward Smith is an attorney in private practice. He has served in the office of the state's attorney, and he has argued cases in front of the Supreme Court of the United States. David Jaros is an associate professor at the University of Baltimore School of Law, whose scholarly focus is on criminal law and criminal procedure and the like. Gentlemen, welcome.
Oh, good morning, Tom.
We're glad to have you here. So, Ed Smith, in order to prove a conviction for manslaughter, to get a conviction for manslaughter, what does the state have to prove in the case of Officer Porter?
Actually, there are two types of manslaughter in Maryland. There's voluntary and involuntary manslaughter. Voluntary, of course, being meaning to do your act. That's the scienter necessary to find... voluntary manslaughter, death of a human being, which is not premeditated. Involuntary manslaughter, reckless disregard, that is what is needed to be proven beyond a reasonable doubt, the standard of proof in any criminal case.
Mm-hmm. So, David Jaros, the state has to prove that Officer Porter could have, this is a woulda, coulda, shoulda kind of situation, he could have done things to prevent the injuries that led to Mr. Gray's death.
That seems likely. That seems, everything is speculation here. We haven't seen the state's evidence. They haven't been totally open about what theory they have for conviction. But most likely it's going to be something along the lines of that the officer was aware that he had a duty to act and that he failed to do that duty, knowing that there was a high probability that could lead to Freddie Gray's death.
Okay. We should remind folks that Officer Porter was called onto the scene in the middle of this situation where Mr. Gray was being transported from where he was originally picked up to Baltimore Police Headquarters. Ed Smith, what do you make of the decision by Judge Williams not to sequester the jurors in this case?
Well, Tom, sequestration is a very unique and not often used tenet of the law. It requires one to believe that the jury may be prejudiced in some way or there may be some tampering with the jury. And sequestration, I think I've only had it done in two trials in 43 years in the law. So I think the decision by Judge Williams, until you find out if you can get a fair jury, which is what's going on this morning, was not in any way unique or was not something that could not be anticipated. Mm-hmm. And Judge Williams is a very good judge, by the way. Been in front of him many times.
Yeah, a lot of folks speak very highly of Judge Williams. David Jarosz, I mean, if the jury isn't sequestered, there is a gag order. I mean, the judge has ordered the defense and the prosecuting attorneys not to discuss the case, but the jurors are going to be, they're going to at least have access to all the chatter of people like us and people on Facebook and people in the media, national and local.
You know, it is a concern. There is a presumption that we typically make, which is that jurors will listen to what the judge tells them. And the judge will instruct them to stay away from the media, to stay off of Twitter, to not go on the web. And the presumption is that jurors will listen to them. I think that the fact that the judge is not choosing to sequester at least improves the chance that we'll be able to draw a jury here in Baltimore.
The judge has also allowed that the jury at Smith will be anonymous. So folks will not at least immediately know their names. What do you make of that? Is that also
unusual? I think
unusual?
It's a good move. People tend to be frozen just like a batter when you kind of put them out there. People are very excited about this. Some are protesting even as we speak downtown. And people can put pressure on others who are not familiar with the jury system and who come just to do their duty. So it's a good move not to have them revealed at this point. Of course, anybody in the courtroom will be able to see who they are once the jury is seated. But right now, I think he's being very cautious, as he should be. That is Judge Williams.
Yeah, and it's not necessarily the case that the jurors will remain anonymous forever. It's just that at the moment they're not going
to. That is absolutely correct. And we have a very weak system of ferreting out jurors here in Maryland. We don't get to question them individually like they do in California and other states. And so a judge just gives questions to the jurors that defendants and the prosecutors give them, and they are asked whether or not they could be fair. Through a series of questions, usually no more than about 26 to 30 questions.
On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. That's Ed Smith. He's an attorney in private practice. We're also joined by David Jarosz from the University of Baltimore School of Law. And David Jarosz, I was fascinated by some wording in one of the motions that the defense made, a pretrial motion, in which they said, quote, "It's possible, indeed probable, that an acquittal of Officer Porter will lead to further civil unrest." And then he talks about, you know, then this had to do with sequestration and with the anonymity of the jurors. Is the fact that there's always the possibility of more violence given in the eventuality of an acquittal of any of these officers, is that going to be something that the prosecution will use as part of their defense strategy or the defense? I mean, that seems crazy.
No, I don't think that'll be a part of either the prosecution or defense strategy for trying to achieve a guilty verdict or an acquittal. It becomes relevant in the picking of the jury. There are sort of two sides to the argument that the defense has made in terms of why the case should be moved out of Baltimore. The first, which is a relatively weak one, is that there's been media exposure to the case and the jurors have sort of pre-decided the issues based on publicity. The weakness in that argument, which was pointed out in a hearing, is that we live in the age of the internet, and so the entire country has been able to see all of this publicity. If you move this to Howard County, the same people read the same stuff off the web. So that's not as strong an argument. The second argument, though, is that jurors may be concerned that they are returning to the same community that may see violence based on their verdict. And if that could affect their verdict, that is an issue for a question of whether or not the case should be tried in Baltimore, and that will be something the judge explores today in the next few days, picking the jury.
Mm-hmm. And Ed Smith, it's not completely untenable that the trial might eventually be moved. I mean, the judge has said, we're going to try to pick a jury here in Baltimore, and if for some reason we can't get an unbiased jury, we might consider moving it.
Absolutely. The personal right of the defendants to receive a fair trial is well embedded in Anglo-Saxon law. And if through the process they get 200-300 people to come in today and everybody's heard of the case and people have developed already predisposed opinions about what should be done, then the court still has the right under the statute, which requires removal to a jurisdiction of less impact, is the way the statute reads, along with the chief judge of the Court of Appeals and of the administrative judge, Judge Pearson here in Baltimore City, then that can and will be done. Mm-hmm. Somerset County is a favorite because they are a jurisdiction of lesser impact across the bridge. Or up in Western Maryland, that is another possibility. Oakland and up in other counties where there's not as much at stake, because the boiling point here, unfortunately, in Baltimore is an emotional one. It's not one that's made of people who are being deliberate and who believe in the rule of law and the common sense which people have to look at these things to determine exactly where they should fall. The justice system will take care of it eventually, and as lawyers, we have to have faith in that fact.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, David Jarris, in terms of an appeal, the possibility of appeal, I mean, Judge Williams is going to be very scrutinized very, very closely throughout this entire thing, because when he makes certain rulings on certain things, like, for example, his ruling about whether or not Mr. Porter's previous interactions with Freddie Gray are going to be relevant and can be discussed at the trial. These things are crucial to how this case is going to proceed.
They are very important. And I think that raises an interesting issue about the case, which is we have to remember that this is the trial against Officer Porter. This is not all of the issues that are raised by the Freddie Gray case. Officer Porter comes along and becomes part of the scene after Freddie Gray is chased, after he is seized. All those questions about, was it appropriate for them to chase him? Was it appropriate for them to arrest him? None of those are sort of an issue in the case. Indeed, the quality of the ride that that Freddie Gray received is not an issue in Officer Porter's case.
Mm-hmm.
It remains a very real question about what we will ultimately explore in this particular criminal trial relative to all of these other issues.
And Ed Smith, you've argued cases in front of Judge Williams. Justin Fenton had an interesting piece in The Sun a day or two ago about the fact that Judge Williams has a background in prosecuting police when he was with the Justice Department. If you're a defense attorney, is that good news, bad news, neutral news? What do you think?
If you know Judge Williams, it's not an issue at all. We all wear two hats, and some of us wear many hats as lawyers. That's how we're trained. And judges, who are supposed to be the best of us, as some would say, and some would say sometimes they're the worst of us, but at least in this particular instance, this judge is a person who can wear the hat and wear it well. He won't let it fall off so that justice will not be done. And if he makes a mistake, well, we're all human, and there is an appellate court who will straighten him out.
Yeah, so there's a system in place that's supposed to address all of these things.
Absolutely. Yeah. And yeah. Oftentimes, when it gets down to the nitty and the gritty of what has to be done, no one stands alone to make a decision over somebody's life that cannot be
appealed. Just real quick as we finish up, Dave.
Yeah, just real quick to add to that, which is I think there's a point to which the system is not responding to everything related to this case, and I hope the public comes to recognize that
right.
This is raising all kinds of social and political issues that are not going to be resolved by the criminal
case.
Not in this case.
Okay, well, we will have you guys back to talk more about this as these many trials proceed. Thanks so much. Edward Smith is an attorney in private practice here in Baltimore. David Jarris, an assistant, or associate professor rather, at the University of Baltimore School of Law. Stay tuned to WIPR for complete coverage of all the trials in the Freddie Gray case. Kenneth Burns is at the courthouse today, and we'll be hearing from him later as well, and of course throughout all six trials. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Coming up, Living Questions, our series on religion in the public sphere. That's up after a break for the news. First, here is Mr. Sterner.
Thanks, Tom. You're listening to the Maryland Morning Podcast, a service of your public radio, WIPR, in Baltimore. Find more podcasts at WIPR.org and tell us what you think by email, mdmorning@WIPR.org. Now, back to the podcast.
On 88.1, I'm Tom Hall. It's time now for another installment in our monthly series, Living Questions, in which we examine the role of religion in the public sphere. We're producing this series in partnership with the Institute for Christian and Jewish Studies. Last week here on Maryland Morning, we talked about Islamophobia and the increasing tension over issues like refugees between American Muslims and political leaders of other faith traditions. Today, a conversation with two Christian pastors, an Episcopal priest and a Lutheran minister, whose congregations made the decision to merge together into one religious community. the Reverend David Eisenhuth, the pastor of the Lutheran Church of the Holy Comforter, and Reverend T. Stewart Lucas, the rector of the Episcopal Church of the Nativity, join me in the studio to talk about the reasons behind the decision to combine their two North Baltimore congregations. Good morning to you both.
Good morning. Good morning. It's great to be here.
So, Reverend Eisenhuth, it's been about a month. You decided to make this announcement or effect this merge on All Saints Day, November 1st, so, you know, 3 weeks or so. How's it going so far?
Oh, it's going very well. It has exceeded our expectations, and by all accounts, from speaking with my members in particular, they're very pleased and feel particularly welcome at Nativity, and I think we're glad we made the move.
Good. And you are, Reverend Lucas, worshiping at Nativity.
We are at our Cedarcroft Road address, just off of York Road, just north of Northern Parkway.
Mm-hmm. And so the other church had to move to you.
They have, right. And are still in the process of moving. So mm-hmm. It's about putting two families together and all of the stuff. And we all have lots of closets, and so we're cleaning those things up and organizing a lot of details.
So Reverend Eisenhuth says that it's exceeded your expectations. What were your personal expectations when you went into this?
It was hard to know. I knew we were going to have more people in the church and that worship was going to feel better. And it worship has exceeded my expectations as well. The sense of community and the joy that we've expressed just in singing together is different with the numbers we have now and the excitement for what we're going to do together in Baltimore.
Uh-huh. And so your congregations, when they were separate, numbered on a typical Sunday about what?
About 40 to 50 worshipers.
So now we're in the hundreds?
Yes, we're well over 100.
Yeah, so that makes it a much bigger, perhaps a joyfuler noise.
It is indeed. You know, when you've got a choir of 6 or 15, there's a big difference.
Yeah.
Well, we had reached a critical mass where we were no longer able really to even have committees because people were doing all kinds of things and just burning out. And we were saddled with a huge building built for a congregation 10 times the size of the one we have now. And so because of our desire to focus on something other than the building, we decided we really needed to have a renewed sense of mission. And so that's what prompted our search for a partner.
Mm-hmm. And so part of this, Father Lucas, is financial. I mean,
sure.
There's economies of scale that you can achieve. You don't need two organs. You don't need two photocopy machines, that kind of stuff. But that's not the was that the primary reason or was that a secondary reason?
Well, we're all in nonprofit ministry trying to run nonprofits. We have to look at those numbers, but we don't think it's about money or members, but really about mission and ministry. It's not about maintenance. It's about what God is calling us to do together to make change that we all know we need here in Baltimore and around the world.
What kind of change can you make now that you've combined that you were not able to make prior?
Well, as I said, worship and creative ministry, number one, but also just in the outreach projects when we're filling stockings for the Salvation Army or shoeboxes that we distribute on the ships down at the port, you know, we can do twice as many together. And we bring our energy and enthusiasm for that and are already looking at other ways that we're going to get involved in the community through local schools and working, supporting education and several other different opportunities.
Reverend T. Stewart Lucas, he's the rector of the Episcopal Church of the Nativity. We're also joined by the Reverend David Eisenhuth. He's the pastor of the Lutheran Church of the Holy Comforter. The two congregations merged on the first of this month. On 88.1, you're listening to Living Questions, our series in which we examine the role of religion in the public sphere. I'm Tom Hall. Gentlemen, more than a quarter of American adults, about 28%, according to the Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life that did a survey just a few months ago, more than a quarter have left the faith in which they were raised. They've either gone to another faith or they've sort of dropped faith completely out of their lives. This is a trend that's happening not just in the United States, but around the world. Reverend Eisenhuth, is this merger a way of addressing that issue that you and anybody in the business of being clergy has to confront in today's world?
Oh, absolutely. I think that there are reasons why people have left the church. I had a couple come to my congregation, and they came for a couple of weeks and stopped coming. So I contacted them and asked them what was the matter. And they said to me that we sounded desperate every Sunday. We were talking about money. We were talking about concerns of the building. And I came to realize that Jesus really didn't talk a lot about buildings and certainly had no knowledge about boilers, which was one of our major concerns with the monster down in the basement. And so when we began thinking about this, we thought, maybe people are not coming because they don't have a sense of mission. What is the ministry of this congregation to be? And it wasn't the building. It was to be with other people, trying to live out what Jesus wants us to do, which is to reach out to other people, to learn about the faith and come together as a family and as a community. And that's what we've discovered at Nativity.
So, Father Lucas, that rings true. I mean, this is a matter of not having to worry about some of the nuts and bolts things of running congregations so that you can worry about other things.
Right. And that we're also getting over ourselves. The younger people in my generation are tired of infighting and fighting over issues and over labels and who's in and who's out. And we believe, and those were big parts of our premarital conversations, was do we believe the same thing? Are we both welcoming everyone to the table? And we are. And that, I think, is why we're getting along so well together.
Well, let me ask you that very question. Do you believe the same thing? Which is to say, are there theological differences, theological interpretations of Scripture, etc., that are different between Episcopalians and Lutherans?
I think if you look at the core, no, there are not any differences. We're all serving the same Lord. But in the intricacies of how we take communion and silly things like that that don't matter to God a whole lot, I think we're really alike. And so we have this concordat that goes back 10 or 15 years, and now I've forgotten the year. We have that support from our bishops and from our synod and our diocese that say this is good stuff, mm-hmm. And this is the wave of the future.
So, Reverend Eisenhuth, that's another question. I mean, what has the synod said about it? Because there might be some subtle differences, or as Father Lucas says, some of the silly things like, you know, the way communion's distributed, that may not be in the larger scope of things all that important. But if the Lutheran synod has an opinion about, you know, same-sex marriage or some of the larger issues, that doesn't happen to concur with the Episcopalian diocese, how does that get worked out?
Well, we've remained two separate congregations. We're still two separate entities and sharing the building, but also sharing mission and ministry. We actually sent out spies when we first started talking about this, and one of my members went to Nativity on one of those really snowy days in February and received a very gracious welcome. And he came back and reported that this might be a possible mission partner, so we sent out more spies. And then I had a conversation with Stuart, and it was very fruitful, and that was 8 months ago, and here we are together. And we started talking about the ways in which we welcome all people and our desire to help in spiritual formation, which is one of the most important things I think we can do together. This whole thing has been helped immensely by the fact that we pretty much are the same. You know, someone's going to sit in somebody else's seat, someone's going to take somebody else's parking space, but in terms of what we believe, that really was pretty much in line with what we each believe.
Yeah, interesting. So this gets juicy here. They're sending spies to each other's places. That's great. Did you have any congregants, you know, dress up as Lutherans and go over and crash the party over there?
No, but the first time we were there, we certainly checked out their kitchen to see what kind of equipment they had that we could bring over and make our dinner parties even more fun and fellowship dinners. But we were invited to come and worship with them and vice versa. And so we tried it out three or four different times and felt that same sense of camaraderie, mainly because our congregations are so similar demographically. Together, we have people from 10 different countries. And so a large Liberian population, and that really has helped us as well. We've found a welcome in each other's communities.
Because I would guess, and you can tell me whether or not this is a legitimate stab, that temperamentally, if the two of you didn't get along famously, then your congregations aren't going to get along famously. That this has a lot to do with the interpersonal relationship that the two of you have been able to cultivate. Is that a decent guess?
Oh, absolutely. I've been a solo pastor for 35 years, and the idea of working with somebody was very intriguing to me. And at first I wondered if that was going to be possible and where would I have office space and to whom would I be reporting and things like that. And as soon as I met Stuart, it was really a great experience. And I left there thinking, wow, this would be wonderful for me, because after 35 years of ordained ministry, I had begun to feel a bit burned out. And Stuart is extremely enthusiastic and has wonderful ideas. I bring a plethora of experiences and different things like that that I've been doing, but I'm open to anything. And I think that that's one of the hallmarks of our congregations.
Yeah, so Stuart Lucas, it's a boost for your colleague and for you as well.
Absolutely. And we were smart enough to reach out and get some help in that premarital counseling, as I said earlier. The two of us have a clergy coach that's helping us figure out those things. What are our expectations? What are our leadership styles? Where are our gifts complementary? And what can we do to relieve the other? And so far, it's working really great.
So I can imagine that, you know, when you presented this idea to your respective congregations, that people could easily get their arms around the financial argument,
sure.
You know, running two buildings and all that stuff. But I wonder, what were the concerns, Father Lucas, that your congregants had, for example, about the actual merger, about, you know, worshiping with people from a different branch of Christianity? What did they worry about before it happened? And then how have those fears played out over these last few weeks?
Well, the first question really was, do they welcome everybody? Do they welcome gay and lesbian people? Do they welcome divorced people, people of different color, of different ethnic backgrounds, of different mental capabilities? And when we looked at it, that was a yes, a resounding yes. And then second was the intricacies of worship. Because we're Episcopalians and we like our order, we like the way things are done, and we've been doing it for hundreds of years. And you know, there's so many similarities and so many things that, quite frankly, our Lutheran brothers and sisters do better than we do, and we're quick to adopt those.
And did you get any pushback on this when you presented this to your Lutheran congregation?
Well, I think the only pushback was from many of the people who had been there their whole lives, and the thought of leaving a building that has seen witness to births, baptisms, marriages, and funerals. That was very difficult for some people. And when the financial realities were presented and the sense that, well, we could do more because we'd be better together, that did help people a lot. To be honest, some people left the congregation and went to other places. Others have one older woman said to me that she had always hoped that she'd be buried from that building, and I said, well, there was one choice.
Yeah, right. What has happened to that building? The building is up for sale.
A number of people have expressed interest in it, and we hope that it would be another faith community that would buy it, although some people who do ballroom dancing were interested in having that huge space so 250 people could dance together. I at first thought, well, I think I'd rather faith community, but I'm open to anything. It's a beautiful building. I know it will serve whoever purchases, and I hope it's purchased soon. If someone's looking for a big building, I can show you one.
Yeah, right. Well, we don't do a whole lot of real estate on this show, but you know, our best wishes to you both, and I do appreciate both of your coming by, and we wish you blessings and great luck with this very interesting experiment.
Thank you very much. We appreciate your time.
The Reverend David Eisenhuth is the pastor of the Lutheran Church of the Holy Comforter. The Reverend T. Stuart Lucas is the rector of the Episcopal Church of the Nativity. I'm Tom Hall. It's Maryland Morning. You've been listening to Living Questions, our monthly series on religion in the public sphere, produced by WIPR in partnership with the Institute for Christian and Jewish Studies. Lots more ahead on Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us. Just days after the football play X's and O's opened at Baltimore's center stage, Frank Gifford, the late Hall of Famer and sportscaster, became the highest-profile former player in the league who was found to have had brain damage linked to his football injuries. Theater critic J. Wynn Russick brings us her review of this timely new sports docudrama.
Somewhere between Berkeley, California, last January, and Baltimore, now, the play X's and O's lost its subtitle. A football love story. When you see Berkeley Rep's co-production with Center Stage, love isn't the first emotion that comes to mind. Fandom, fervor, loyalty, definitely. But love? Well, as the saying goes, love is blind. Blind to such football health hazards as concussion and CTE, chronic traumatic encephalopathy, the condition that used to be called punch drunk. The play also raises other issues, but brain damage is the focus. X's and O's is a docudrama created by two avowed football fans, K.J. Sanchez and Jenny Mersine. Mersenne, who also appears in the cast, is the daughter of a veteran NFL running back. He was one of more than 50 people, football players, their families, and fans, interviewed for this play. Sanchez is the author of Reentry, a play about Marines returning from war, produced at Center Stage 5 years ago. Reentry avoided taking an overt political stand. X's and O's does take a stand. Football needs to be safer, period. There are scenes of a team physician showing slides of CAT scans and videos of players being injured. At the performance I attended, the audience gasped when actress Marilee Talkington, as the doctor, showed footage of a player's body and head going in opposite directions upon impact. Then there's the testimony of players who suffered and played through serious injuries. Although 90% of the script consists of verbatim transcripts, the names are changed. Here's the testimony of a former player who happens to be portrayed on stage by another former NFL player, Dwight Hicks.
The first game back after an injury, that's the defining moment, okay? You got to get in and make sure you take a good hard lick. I mean, you have to make sure you put yourself right in line and make sure you get hit.
The playwrights insist they didn't set out to write an exposé. But X's and O's comes closer to that than to theater. There simply isn't enough conflict. Football-inflicted brain injuries are terrible. No argument. The play makes the point with historical sections that explain, for example, that in 1905, 19 players died on the field. And it makes the point with modern-day sections about players who suffered early-onset Alzheimer's, dementia, or committed suicide. It's strong stuff. But for the most part, it's presented in a way that's more informational than theatrical. This despite slick direction by Tony Taccone and an agile cast of six in multiple roles. A rare instance of theatrical flair comes when the wives of two players share the stage with the son of another. Marilee Talkington and Jenny Mersenne play the wives. Eddie Ray Jackson plays the son.
It's hard for me to say when did all of this begin. It really happened slowly.
After the first few years, it wasn't full-fledged, but it started. I could see things that weren't right.
For my dad, I would say it was like an erratic kind of change of personality. Real sudden.
The production's design is high-tech with NFL flair. ESPN's Sports Center would feel right at home on Todd Rosenthal's set. Alexander V. Nichols' lighting includes two banks of stadium-style lights as well as projections. And Jake Rodriguez's sound makes ample use of football-inspired themes. And for Baltimore theatergoers, there are references to the Ravens and even the Colts. A comment about the Colts leaving still gets a rise. Plays about football have generated attention lately. Last season, Olney Theater Center produced a powerful look at college ball called Colossal. X's and O's seems more concerned with making its case than dramatizing it. Even the most diehard football lovers will find it difficult to argue with the play's premise. But they'll also find more drama played out on the field than on stage.
X's and O's is at Center Stage in Baltimore until December 20th. Theater critic J. Wynn Russick joins us most Monday mornings here on Maryland Morning. Next week, she'll give us her take on the Fells Point Corner Theater's latest offering. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. After a break for news, we'll take a trip to the Peabody Library to check out an exhibit about the acclaimed writer John Barth. Stay with us.
Sing it!
If you want to join in on the conversation, go to our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning, and make a comment. We'd love to hear from you. You can also check out our audio archives there and learn more about what you just heard, or even make a pledge to support local programming. Again, that's at wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
Last week, I went to the Peabody Library to check out an exhibition devoted to the work of the acclaimed novelist, essayist, and teacher John Barth. The show is called Lost and Found in the Funhouse, an allusion to one of Barth's most famous novels. I spoke with Gabrielle Dean, the curator of literary rare books and manuscripts at the Sheraton Libraries at Johns Hopkins. She's the curator of the Barth exhibition. Gabrielle Dean, welcome back to Maryland Morning. Good to see you.
Good to see you.
So John Barth, why an entire exhibition related to this particular writer? Some folks have suggested that he really has had a lot to do in shaping American literature in the 20th century and the early 21st century. In what way do you think that's the case?
Well, that is one really important part of this story, is his role in what some folks call postmodern literature, which is a word that makes people back away from you very slowly sometimes. But what it really means in his case is that he's participating in a really long tradition of writing fiction that comments on itself as fiction, which is kind of appropriate, I think, to our contemporary moment, where we're always sort of seeing reflections of ourselves in our Facebook profiles and our Twitter feeds. He was kind of already there with this technique called metafiction, fiction about fiction. The other thing I think that's really important about John Barth is he's really a local boy who kind of made it big. He sort of followed the American dream in its literary version. He's from a small town on the Eastern Shore. He went to a high school that only had 11 grades. He ended up at a good university where he struggled and worked and made a life for himself as a writer, which, you know, is pretty impressive from those beginnings.
And that university, of course, is Johns Hopkins University, which is the sponsor and the connection of Barth to this community. He was a student at Hopkins, an undergraduate and a graduate student, and then for many years on the faculty of the writing seminars. Very influential as a teacher as well as a novelist.
Yeah, super influential as a teacher. And that's one of the things that was one of the really fun discoveries of the archive when it came to Hopkins, is we were delighted to find in it things like notebooks and drafts of manuscripts and published books, but we also found folders of all his teaching notes and his syllabi, and it became really clear that he devoted as much thought and careful consideration to his teaching as he had to his writing. He also didn't force his students to follow in his footsteps. He let them be who they were as writers. He encouraged them to be different kinds of writers. And I think that's a really overlooked part of the writing life, you know, encouraging the next generation in all different kinds of ways.
So we're standing in front of one of the cases here at this exhibition, and I'll admit that I'm personally a big sucker for manuscripts. And this is, the exhibition, of course, is called Lost and Found in the Funhouse, and we're looking at some very early manuscripts and early versions of the book Lost in the Funhouse when it was published. So we're staring at a notebook where he's made some notes, and then we've got one that he's labeled first draft, and then we see a typed draft that has some, you know, marginalia in it. What do you think you learn about John Barth, or for that matter, any author, when you look at these handwritten manuscripts and you see its evolution from a handwritten manuscript to a typed manuscript to then published books?
I think one of the things you see is how hard he worked. I mean, each one of these stages in the written evolution of a story, it's a pretty well-known story and an amazing story, and it, when you read it, it just feels kind of magical, you know, that you're flowing along in the story. But to get to that point, he did so many notes and drafts and revisions and changes along the way. So that's a story of hard work embedded in, you know, the fun pleasure that we get to have as readers, and it's invisible to most of us. I mean, writers make it their job to make that work invisible. So I love manuscripts too, and I love seeing the different changes, the minute changes sometimes that have a really big impact on your reading experience. It's pretty fascinating. And, you know, we are so lucky that he was working at a time when people left behind traces of all those stages. It's a lot harder now if people are going into a document on their, you know, laptop and just updating that document. It takes some pretty fancy digital forensics to retrieve those stages now. But then in the late 20th century, you know, yeah, he wrote on paper, so we can see every step that he took.
Let's take a few steps of our own over here to another case here at the exhibition at the Peabody Library. And this actually is one of an unpublished novel. We see, again, a few stages of the manuscript. So this collection that the Barths have bequeathed to Hopkins includes all sorts of stuff. And it even includes his own personal library, the books that he had in his library, some of which are autographed and annotated by some pretty famous people. What do we know about this unpublished novel?
Well, it's called The New Science, and he was working on it in the mid-1990s. I think he abandoned it because he wasn't happy about it, and I'm not sure how complete it is. It doesn't look complete because it looks short. And, you know, if you've ever read a John Barth novel, you know that a lot of them are pretty long. So scholars haven't had a chance to sort of poke this one yet. We don't really know exactly how it fits into his work as a whole, but I guess I found it kind of touching that this writer who has published 17 works of fiction just seemed to have it down, has a whole process of drafting, revising, publishing, was incredibly successful. He also struggled, and some things he just didn't like and he decided not to work on anymore.
And it's a fairly courageous act to then allow this to be displayed publicly. That's really interesting. It's one thing to be judged by your work. It's another thing to be judged by the stuff that you decided wasn't your work.
And all the notes that he took, those are on display as well. Those are in the archive for scholars to look at. I agree. It is courageous, and it's kind of I think it's a testament to his faith in the sort of ongoing legacy of writing. You know, he's going to let people look at his detritus and his rejects and his drafts, because maybe we'll all learn something from it.
There's another display over here in one of the cases that has some of the publicity that he received, newspaper articles, magazine articles, that kind of thing. He eventually became a very well-known writer, a very famous person. Did it change him at all? Was he writing any differently after he became very successful and well-known as opposed to his early career?
His writing did change in the late 60s, but it really wasn't, I don't think it was a response to success. It was a response to, you know, the world was changing, and he was kind of staying on top of current events. He wanted his writing to be relevant. He was pretty well known, but the sort of ironic thing is he is well known. The ironic thing is that he's in some ways known more for the things he wrote earlier on than the things he wrote later on. And one great sort of expression of that is this case right behind us that's got these reprints and sort of pulp novel versions of his works. They made them look like, with the cover designs, they made them look like science fiction novels or fantasy novels or romance novels. And it's true that there's romance, you know, there's relationships in some of his works, there's, you know, voyages to other times in history. You could sort of lump it into a sci-fi or a fantasy genre, but that's really not what he was doing. But his publishers, to get him to a wider market, were trying to package things in a way that would appeal to those tastes. That's pretty interesting, I think.
And it certainly has appealed to an awful lot of folks and with a lot of different tastes. This is a terrific show. Gabrielle Dean, thanks so much for your time. Appreciate it.
Thank you. It was fun talking with you.
Gabrielle Dean is the curator of literary rare books and manuscripts in the Department of Special Collections at the Sheraton Libraries at Johns Hopkins University. Lost and Found at the Fun House is at the Peabody Library in Baltimore till the end of February. We've got a link to more information on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. That's it for us today. Coming up Wednesday on the program, what to do with four monuments in Baltimore that celebrate figures in the Confederacy, an artist who's used a personal tragedy to inspire his latest project, and I'll visit the new exhibition on Islamic art at the Walters Art Museum. Hope you can join us. Until then, I'm Tom Hall. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great day.